Please join me in a very warm welcome for our speaker tonight. I met this guy the very first meeting I went to. Never heard him tell his story, but I can't count how many meetings I've been in with him, whether they were book studies or a variety of different things. So I'm really excited to hear his story tonight. If you would, please join me in welcoming Mike Kay from the Friends of Bill W. Group.
Keep an eye on that. My name is Mike and I'm an alcoholic.
Mike.
Yeah, thanks for asking me to be here to speak for your anniversary this month. Jake, we've been together probably about 7 years now, trudging this road to happy destiny. So congratulations to you on 9 years. And thank you all for being here. My home group is the Friends of Bill W., which meets at 7 p.m. on Thursdays. And we also have a noon meeting, as Bill sees it, meeting at noon. So if you're ever out in that part of town, north of town, come out and see us. We also sponsor a couple other meetings. They're just meetings. There's a prayer and meditation meeting that meets the same church, Tuesdays at 12:30. And Saturday mornings, another one of our home group members sponsors that Saturday morning meeting at 9:30. So plenty of opportunities to meet up with us out there. So what I'm supposed to do tonight, our book says when we share our stories, we share in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I'll hopefully cover all three of those before I get done. I try to follow some kind of order, but you know, before I get up here, I always was taught to say a prayer and turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him and let His words be mine. And so I say a little prayer and ask Him to speak to me today through my heart. So, and also if there's a message that somebody's meant to receive tonight, that I might be able to share or touch on that, and maybe there's something they can relate to. One of the problems I had early on in sobriety was with comparing and identifying. And I looked at the people around and I sized them up. I took their quick inventory before I knew how to take an inventory. And I would say, okay, well, you know, I'm not as bad as they are. And I would compare myself away from them rather than listen to their stories and see what I can come up with to identify. What part of their story or their experience can I identify with? So my hope tonight is that you can identify with something that I say tonight, whether you can completely relate to it or not, that there's something in there that you can identify. And I challenge you in all your meetings to work on identification, because that's what draws us in. You know, comparing allowed me to not necessarily pull myself up, but draw myself away from that center, you know, recognizing that I was the same as everybody else. And to give you an example of that point, during COVID, I was asked to participate in a Zoom meeting. Somebody had done some service work up in Hampton. And the format was they invite somebody to share for 20 minutes, and then they pick somebody else, and then they go around, and that, whether they share on that or whatever the topic is for that meeting. And I was so focused on what I was going to say, because I'm used to being asked to speak, you know, for the whole time of the meeting. Whenever I'm asked to condense it down to 20 minutes, I don't know where to quickly, you know, begin, find my way, and tell you how wonderful it is. So I shared for about 20 minutes. I don't even know what I said. And then there's this large pause. I'm thinking, did I miss, you know, understand the instructions? And then finally, the person who was chairing the Zoom meeting said, Mike, you're supposed to pick somebody else. And I just picked a face in the crowd right in the Zoom meeting. And it was another woman, not of my age, probably not any type of background. She said, Mike, you don't know me. We've never met. You're a man. I'm a woman. We come from probably different parts of the world. She said, but you just told my story. You know, and that's the wonderful thing about this program. And that's why I challenge you to focus on identification. Find those little bits and pieces. The other information that was shared with me early on was when people are sharing in a meeting, this one of the old timers told me, she said she turns her chair or makes her body position shift and looks at the person who's speaking, because it forces her to pay attention and she doesn't want to miss out on what that tidbit was that she was supposed to pick up that day. So those are some tools that I found that helped me to identify myself in and stay connected to the people in these rooms. So a little bit of what it was like Steve always told me that we had to get sober by 8:30, so I hope I hit that pretty close. And I'm not going to spend a long time, you know, telling you about my drinking life, because I had my first drink at 12 and my last drink at 52, so we'd be here for a while if I told you all the stories. What I want to hit on is some of the highlights, and I'll tell you about, you know, my relationship with alcohol, then I'll give you a couple highlights of some things that early on that were signs of alcoholic behavior, and I didn't know that at the time, but looking back, and I start to see the connections and the parallels. And this first thing is that when I was about, I would guess I was probably about 5 years old is my earliest recollection. I could have been a little younger than that. Is I saw my family, they're not from here, my parents are Canadian. So when we get together, there's like big family get-togethers, and it's always a lot of fun. And for those adults that got together, drinking was involved and drinking was fun. And that was my first recollection of that, is that before I knew what alcohol would produce in me, I saw the effects that alcohol had on other people, and I wanted what they had. And I made that connection all the way through my early adulthood that drinking was fun, and in order to have fun, we had to be drinking. And you know, there were some circumstances where we got caught. The first beer I had, it wasn't anything glamorous. There's nothing social about it. My brother had snuck a couple of beers out and hid them in the woods behind our house. They were, whatever it was that my dad bought, was like 99 cents a six pack at the grocery store. It wasn't anything, you know, wonderful or fancy. And we drank those warm beers, not because they were good, because I can distinctly remember how terrible it tasted, but I drank for the effect that I wanted that alcohol to produce in me. You know, I saw that effect in other people, and as a young teenager, I wanted that effect in me. And I already started smoking and doing some other things I shouldn't be doing. You know, so this was just another progression in my lack of maturity, as opposed to my maturity as I was growing older and being exposed to these things. The first real incident I had with drinking was my 15th birthday. We went to a football game, a high school football game. It was homecoming. We were supposed to get some pizza and come home. But there was this whole plan afoot early on where we would have some beer stashed and we were going to get it. And we did that, but I don't know how the whole thing transitioned, but we ended up at some house party of two of the girls that we went to school with. They were sisters and their parents were out of town. And my brother ran up to me, and at this point I'd probably had two, maybe three beers at this point at one time. Usually it was only two. My brother and this friend of ours would go out and get a six pack. And he grew a beard when he was 15, so he didn't have trouble being able to buy alcohol back then. And so we would get the six pack and split it three ways, and you know, be forced to drink that beer down just to get that effect. But on my 15th birthday, my brother, who's 2 years older than me, kind of lost track of me. And it was November. It was cold. It was up in Michigan. And so I had this big, heavy coat on. And when my brother caught up with me, he said, "You're drunk." He said, "How much you've had to drink?" And I recall I was holding, I said, "Well, three, four." And I looked down in my coat pocket. I had five and six in here. And it was just free. They were giving it away. So I thought they wanted me to enjoy myself and have a good time. And I didn't know until after I'd been sober a little while, this is part of that compare and identify, is I would have never told you, or if you'd asked me, I never would have said I was a blackout drinker. And when I look back on that occasion, on my 15th birthday, there were periods that I remember, and then I didn't remember. There's like gaps in the evening. You know, I distinctly remember being told in the car, next thing I know, you know, my brother's upset because I'm talking to the sheriff. I don't know how these things happen, but they're blank periods in the evening that I can't account for. So we got in a lot of trouble, and the opportunity to drink, you know, was not really prevalent. But holidays, certain occasions, we'd get together. If we found an opportunity, you know, we would drink. And it was probably the age of 16 to 17 where I started going to work and meeting older people and having ready access to alcohol. And that's where the drinking would progress, or the beginning of a progression of the drinking was in my teens. And I would join the military when I was 19. I got to my first duty station in Hawaii. The drinking age was 18. You know, I felt like I had arrived. You know, I was able to drink, you know, the way I thought I deserved to drink. And there, you know, there's nobody there to tell me how much I could or couldn't have. Unless you got in trouble. And somehow, you know, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. There were many, many opportunities where not only should I have been in trouble, I probably should have been locked up somewhere, but I never seemed to get in the trouble. And maybe that's why, you know, my degree, my disease had a long trajectory, you know, a long progression. And as a result of that, you know, I found myself in a lot of scrapes, you know, jumping off the balcony thinking I can do it when I'm drunk, and, you know, breaking the bone in my heel, and just, you know, stupid stuff like that, just drinking like I was. And there were nights where we would start partying on a Saturday afternoon, you know, in the dormitories, and go down to a club on base, and then end up down in Waikiki. So there was a bar that was open at 4 o'clock in the morning. There was a air terminal there that was open 24 hours a day. We could go get some more beer, you know, go down to the beach, pass out because it was dark, sleep for a couple hours, wake up, and there's a cooler right next to us, and we just keep on doing it, you know. So I had many weekends like that. But there was some point in my life where, I can't really explain it, but, you know, I got involved in a relationship, I got married, eventually a child came along, and there was this long period of convincing myself that I can control and manage my drinking. And it went on for many years. But I can also look back in the rearview mirror and see points of progression in my military career, towards the end of my military career. But when I got out in 2004, I was off to the races. You know, I lived with a domineering and controlling mother who turned me over to the Air Force. The Air Force told me what to do for the next 23 years. And at the age of 42, I decided, you know, nobody's going to tell me what to do anymore. I'll do it if I want to do it. And I found myself just doing stupid things, like breaking little rules, like speeding more than I normally would, or, you know, taking up two parking spaces. Just these little mental quirks that I was trying to break all these little rules. And, you know, later on, that would be real easy with the drinking, because the drinking was starting to take on greater proportions when I got out. I'm pretty sure I was a daily drinker at that point, not necessarily a heavy drinker, because again, in my head, I'm still managing my drinking. You know, it's only 3 or 4 in the evening after work, and, you know, no more than 5 or 6 or 8 on the weekend. And what probably really facilitated the advancement after I got out of the military, and I look at this, I got sober in 2014, and I retired in 2004, so that 10-year period, I can look back now and mark these transition points, and I found myself drinking it a lot. But one of the things that really facilitated was my wife of, you know, 20-plus years and I separated in 2006 and divorced in 2007. I lost my father in 2007. My mother had dementia, and I dealt with that for a couple of years. I was in a job that I should have never taken, let alone stayed at, for as many years as I had. And these were all reasons, excuses, you know, plausible denials for why I drank. And I could see the progression from coming home and cracking an ice-cold beer to fixing a mixed drink, because, you know, I really do like a bourbon and 7-Up. That was my favorite drink. But again, I could see the progression in my drinking. And I'll go through this quickly, because then I want to get sober. Is that, and when I look back at the way I was drinking, I was increasing not only the strength of what I was drinking, but also the quantities at that time, and not really realizing what I was doing. So I convinced myself that I stayed in that pattern of controlled drinking for a long period of time because I didn't like a hangover. And at one point, I woke up with a bad hangover, having drunk the night before and had to work that morning. I was working every other Saturday. And I convinced myself, these are the little crazy things that we alcoholics do. I convinced myself that it was the soda, right? There was something with the sugar and the carbonation that immediately went to my head. So I switched to bourbon and water, because it didn't seem to have the same effect. It seemed like I could drink more or drink longer without getting that crazy fuzzy-headed feeling and waking up sick the next day. Well, that progressed to just, you know, bourbon on the rocks. And then it was just bourbon out of the bottle. And then one day I got accused of, you know, smelling like alcohol at 10 o'clock in the morning. And again, I had no of these alcoholic thoughts. I remember one time someone told me that if you drink vodka, they can't smell it on your breath. I don't like vodka. I still don't like vodka, right? In the end, I hated vodka, but it was the thing that fueled the fire. So one day, I'm down on my hands and knees looking for the cheapest bottle of vodka I can find at the ABC store, because I needed the effect. You know, I was no longer drinking for all that fun and merriment that I saw in my family. You know, I wasn't doing it to be social. I wasn't, you know, doing it to have fun with my friends. I was isolating and drinking alone and hiding what I was drinking. If you came to my house and I fixed you a drink, you would never know what I was drinking because I would go in the kitchen and I'd take a shot or two off the bottle, I'd fix you a single, I'd pour me a double, take another shot off the bottle and go back and serve you your drink. And before you were done with yours, I was tinkling the ice in my glass waiting for you to finish so I could offer you another one, and the same thing would happen, right? I'm applying mass amounts of alcohol, but in my brain I can't see that I'm drinking much different from you. And what I've learned since I've gotten sober is when I get together with my family, they don't drink nearly as much as I thought they did, right? And there's one of two things. They never drank like I drank, or they drank more than they normally would because I was the guy goading them on. I was the guy feeding it to them. You know, I'm the guy convincing them, you know, they need to participate in my merriment. And that's just all the warp kind of thinking I had in my head. So it would reach a point where, and again, my drinking was facilitated by the fact that my wife has some pretty intense medical issues that she deals with, and she takes some very strong medications to deal with them. And she's up at weird hours, and she's sleeping at weird hours, and it really facilitated my ability to drink as much as I want, as fast as I could, just waiting for her to wake up. I distinctly recall somewhere near the end of my drinking, about 9:30 on a Sunday morning, and so I would crack one beer and carry that beer around for 3 hours on any given day while I'm sneaking to the cabinet everywhere I had my liquor stashed and drinking that, but carrying around this warm beer. Well, in the morning, I'd carry around this one cup of coffee for 2.5-3 hours, but I'm already three sheets to the wind. And I remember one Sunday, not too long before I got sober, it was about 9:30 in the morning, thinking, I hope she wakes up pretty soon because I'm already hammered. It's only 9:30 in the morning, right? Never thought, you know, so my concern was that she needs to get up to maybe interfere with my ability to get through the day because I'm getting too drunk too early in the day. Just these little crazy things. But it would come to a head on a Thanksgiving weekend. My wife and I were had gone to Sam's Club. She had a membership, but I didn't. So we went there to get tires like 10 o'clock in the morning on the Friday after Thanksgiving. And she said, what's wrong with you? You're acting weird. And then she's like, you smell like alcohol. Have you been drinking? And it just, the whole thing is like, I knew the jig was up, but nothing was really, more was said about it. Because well, we'll talk about this later. Her parents were in town, and they left Sunday. And she asked me, did I think I have a problem with drinking? And I had known, you know, what I was doing was wrong. It wasn't normal, you know, the way I'd been drinking for quite a long time. And for the first time, you know, I was really good at coming up with a quick lie or a quick explanation for something. And sometimes I amazed myself, like, did they really buy that? You know, like, I just threw something out there, like, but they're like, I don't know, it doesn't seem right. But I, you know, they just didn't have enough evidence to call me out on it. A couple times they did, you know, reeking of liquor, you know, 9:30 or 10 o'clock in the morning. But she asked me without thinking, I said yes. And then I realized what I said. And then there was just this flow of emotion that came out of me because I knew what I had been doing was wrong. It all kind of caved in on me, you know. I was sad, I was dejected, I was disappointed with myself. You know, I had become someone who I never thought I could be and never wanted to be, but it is, you know, what it is. That's what I became, you know. And I wouldn't know much about that until I came here. But for whatever reason, she said, well, do you think you need to go to an AA meeting? Like, I don't know where she pulled this from, right? Okay, so I just admitted that I might have a problem with drinking, and now we're talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. Let's, you know, come on. It's a big, big leap, right? There's a big jump there. But I accepted what she was saying. I wasn't prepared to go that night, but, you know, I knew that I needed help. I came to the quick realization that I was in over my head. I had never tried to quit drinking, never really wanted to quit drinking until that point. So when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous 3 days later, on a Tuesday, I started to hear what people were saying. And like I said, I could identify enough to know that I felt like I was in the right place because I knew I needed help. I didn't know if it was going to come from a doctor, you know, a lawyer, a psychiatrist, a psychologist, you know, somebody in the religious profession. But I knew someone needed to help me because I knew I was out of control and there was nothing more that I could do about it. And so with these people in this room, this first meeting, you know, offered me that little bit of hope, you know, experience, strength, and hope. These people had experience with drinking, you know, they planted just a little bit of hope in me. And, you know, that gave me enough strength to just to come back to the next meeting. You know, it sounds corny, we say keep coming back, but, you know, I did. Didn't come back till the next week. I didn't realize, you know, these things were happening throughout the course of the week at this point. So the next week I came back, and he said, well, there's another meeting tomorrow night. You know, do you want to go to that one? I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll check it out. You know, so I'm still going to these meetings. I'm picking up what you're putting down, but I'm not putting down the alcohol. I'm still drinking the way I was drinking when I admitted that I had a problem with it. And so slowly but surely, I would do that for about 2 months. And then finally, I would reach that jumping off point where I couldn't imagine my life with or without alcohol. And in that period of time from I went to my first meeting the first week of December until the first week of February, there were many days that I just tried. I said, I can do this. I can do this, right? I live not too far from here, and I worked in near the Hampton-Newport News Line. And I would get to 664. And so at this point, leading up to AA, I have a pint in my glove box, a pint in my trunk that I go to work with. And I most days I finish that pint because I drink as much as I can before I pull in the parking lot at work. Pop a couple Hall's cough drops in my mouth. I go and sit at my desk, keep my head down, ignore everybody, do my job. Oop, lunch break. I go around the corner of the park, sit in the park, get 4 or 5 nips off that bottle, pretend to read the paper like I can see it, and then go back and finish my day. That became my normal work day. So, you know, at this point, trying to just get to work in the morning without drinking was a monumental task for me. Some days I'd get to 664, some days I'd get to the Monterey Merrimack. There was one day I got all the way into the parking lot and said, I just can't do it. And I reached in the glove box and you know, took a big old swig of that vodka or 3 or 4 before I went in. But one day I reached that jumping off point where I just could not imagine doing this anymore. You know, all the stories that I'd heard from you all about what was waiting for me. You know, there's a lot of yets that haven't happened in my life. I hope I don't have to experience those. I'm told that I'm one of the fortunate ones. Well, with that fortune, you know, comes the burden of comparing and identifying. So I'm kind of circling the wagons there with that, is that if I got here and I didn't lose stuff, yeah, I have all that stuff still to lose if I don't follow, you know, the instructions and the suggestions that are put for me in the big book and in the sponsorship that I found in these rooms and mentorship that I found in these rooms. I have one sponsor. He's a second sponsor I had. It just didn't work out with the first one. But I'll always be grateful for the man who was there, who had the key, opened up the door, and was the hand of AA, and welcomed me in that meeting. And after a while, I asked him to be my sponsor. And he did for me what he could do, but there reached a point where the relationship just wasn't healthy anymore, and it was suggested I move on. And Buster's my sponsor today. He's been my sponsor for about 8 years now. And, you know, he's just a very kind, loving person. You know, he would do anything for me. He took me through the book, the big book. He took me through the 12 and 12, you know, and he shares his 30 years of experience, strength, and hope. But I also latched on to some other people in this room, you know, that had 10, 20, 30 years. And when I became able to listen to what you all were saying, instead of picking apart the way you said it or the tone of your voice or what you're wearing today or, you know, how dare he wear flip-flops in December? You know, just these crazy things that my mind would distract me with. But when I really started to listen to what you all had to share, I was able to identify more and more. I was drawn into the program. And I'll be grateful to those people that were there early on that showed me the importance of service work. You know, our program is based on the triangle principle, and there's three things that represent that. It's unity, service, and recovery. You know, the unity is the fellowship we find in these rooms. Service is giving of myself, getting outside of my self-centered self, and thinking of what I can do to help others instead of what I think I'm entitled to, you know. And then the recovery part is us doing our job, working the steps. And once having worked the steps, you know, we are the hand of AA now. We have a responsibility, you know, to help the still sick and suffering alcoholic when they're ready, when they ask for it. You know, I've learned through sponsoring other people that I can't get anybody sober. I can't wish them sober. I can't pray them sober. I can't make them sober. And there were many people early on that I tried to help. And, you know, there were people there that said, oh, you'll see, you'll see. You shouldn't be doing that, but you'll see. You know, like bringing a guy into my home when he's still drunk, right? But my good friend Steve Becker tells me, I'm the only one he's ever heard of that had a sponsee leave his house and get a DUI on the way to the meeting. So, You know, there's that. But, you know, sponsorship has taught me a lot, not only what to do, but what not to do, you know, to be there, to be that hand of AA and not, you know, to be their father or to be their counselor or to be their financial advisor or any of the other stuff. You know, people ask for advice. I'm going to share my experience, but I'm not here to run their lives. I'm not here to tell them, you know, what they're supposed to do, except to practice those principles as we teach them in all of our affairs, you know, and show them by example. I think that's something I latched onto in the military, and I think there's parallels for me between my military career and what I'm doing in AA today, because I've always believed that a good supervisor leads by example, right? I shouldn't ask you to do anything that I either haven't done myself or I'm not willing to do. And when the push comes to shove, I roll up my sleeves and I prove that I'm willing to do it, and I get in there and do it. So I don't ask my sponsees to do anything that I haven't done myself. And if service is a key component of that, I had people early in my life that mentored me and told me to get involved with service. I never met my sponsor's first sponsor, but he's pretty well known in these parts if you've been around for a little while. He went on to become a delegate for the state of Virginia. And was really well respected in the Smithfield and Suffolk areas. But he said, and we have a mutual friend who's been sober about 25 years, and Tom came to him one day and said, service work will show you a side of sobriety you should not miss. And, you know, so for people that aren't doing all those things, you know, you're just getting a piece of it. I was told when I got here, I can have a bite of an apple or I can eat the whole apple pie. You know, what do you want? You want a little bit of sobriety? Or you want a sane and sober life, right? You know, are you all in? You know, you have both feet in, or are you just tiptoeing in the water? Or do you maybe have one foot out? You know, maybe you think you've got this thing. And one thing I know is that I'll never have it, right? There's a page in our big book that talks about, you know, what I have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual conditioning. And that's really what it's all about. It's what it was about from the beginning. I didn't know it until the end. And it's about what it is today, right? I got to lead a spiritual life, and I have to let go of things, and I have to turn them over to something greater than myself. And for me, that something is what got me here today, right? I had to turn my will and my life, my thoughts and my actions over to something greater than me, because I realized when I got here that I couldn't do it. I could not not drink. I could not stop drinking on my own. And so, you know, back to that transition, after 2 months, the night before was the Super Bowl, and I remember pre-gaming all day. I remember the opening ceremonies, and when I woke up, they were talking about the game with the commentary, and the field's all empty, and I completely blacked out or passed out. I don't know which, but I completely missed the Super Bowl. And that day, I was able to get up, and I got to work without drinking. And I surprised myself. I kept waiting for something to happen, right? Because I had this vision that when I went to work that first day, what fear of what might happen was always worse than the reality of what does for me, right? Fear was a big part of what I found in my step process. So I was created this image of what was going to happen if I didn't drink and I went to work, and I kept waiting for that to happen. Like I was going to pass out, fall on the floor, hyperventilate. I don't know what was going to happen. And all these people who didn't know that I drank would know that I was an alcoholic. And I was never called out at work. No one ever approached me about drinking at work. And God knows I drank plenty. But it was just never an issue. Whether I was really good at eating cough drops or staying away from people, I don't know. But I'm fortunate that I didn't have to suffer those circumstances. But that only lasted till that weekend, because I convinced myself by Sunday that if I just didn't drink during the week, I'd be okay just drinking on weekends. So the next week I made it to Friday. And that went pretty well. It was hard to get to work on Monday, but I got there. And the next week, my weekend started on Wednesday, because it kept getting closer and closer. I realized I just couldn't do this thing. And this would go on for 4 or 5 months, you know, trying to quit, putting together a week. You know, I joke when I pass out the chips that I didn't hear the word continuous until I was about to pick up a 3-month chip, because I thought they were just like membership tokens, right? I want this way of life. I got my white chip. I've been here 30 days. I get the 30-day chip. Somewhere along the line, I started hearing nights, weekends, holidays, consecutive. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. I thought these were just for being in the program. And so, again, pride prevented me from picking another white chip. But I refused to pick up another chip until I earned them honestly. And I was about to pick up, I said I was about 2.5 months sober at this point. So I made it till April. And this will just give you another quick story of what it was like to be this alcoholic. I had not drank at least a week. It might have been 2 weeks at this point. It's now April. Oh, I'm sorry, it's now May. My brother and I are driving to Michigan together for our niece's wedding. And he kept saying, "Are you sure you're going to be okay? You know, because we're going to be around family. There's going to be a lot of drinking." All the way there, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to be fine. So we stop in Ohio. He picks up a 12-pack of beer. We arrive, and there we're sitting around, and I'm thinking, well, surely it would be okay with family just to have one or two beers, right? And I did. I had one or two, went to bed. Everything was fine until I got up the next morning, and the phenomenon of craving was there. You know, the allergy was still in my body. It still kicked in. And I'm thinking, okay, what time is it? You know, where's everybody in the house? What time is lunch? When can I safely start drinking other people's liquor and beer, you know, before it'll be obvious that I'm drinking that early in the day? And just like that, you know, my mind was off and running. And I remember watching my brother-in-law. There's a little cabinet over the stove, right, where everybody hides their liquor. They just keep it out of the reach of the children, right? And I remember he got the bottle out, and he put a couple ice cubes there, and he poured the glass, he put about that much in there. And we talked for hours. Into the night, he put that much down the drain. But I remember, that bothered me the night before, but that morning, I remember where that was. So now, I'm listening in the house, right? How quickly can I get to the cabinet, open the door, get a drink, put the lid on, put it back, and not get caught? And still listen for anybody who might be coming. I was successful about three times, and by that time, it was lunchtime, and you know, we were able to drink beer. But that story ended with the family who had flown couldn't take liquor back. The people who had come across the border from Canada couldn't take open bottles back across the border. So I quickly suggested we put all in my trunk and my brother can enjoy it when we get back. So we left there Sunday afternoon, I think it was, and we would drive for about 2 hours. Now, I was pretty loaded by the time we got on the road driving my car. We would pull into a rest stop. He'd get out to smoke a cigarette because I wouldn't let him smoke in the car. I'd run to the restroom, pretend to go to the restroom, come back out. While he was in the restroom, I'd open up the trunk and hit as much of that liquor as I could, get back in the, behind the wheel, and we drove home from Michigan that way. And that's when I realized, I said, I just can't do this. There's got to be a better way. And, you know, I remember praying that morning, you know, God, please help me. You know, I can't do this on my own. And I thought I was on my way. And about 2.5 months sober, my wife and I went to visit friends in Rehoboth Beach. They run a beach house up there and invite us to join them, and only asked that we provide one dinner. So it's really a nice occasion for us. But that was the that was my last drunk. I remember sitting there on a couch reading the Big Book, went to the refrigerator to get a Coke, and I opened that door. I saw the Coke for just a split second, and I looked in the door. There was a bottle of flavored vodka in the door. And I immediately thought about the story that these two ladies were telling about what they had and how it was and how good it tasted. And just like that, I reached in, I grabbed that bottle, took the lid off, and threw it back, and 2.5 months sober, and just gulped that, whether it was a flavored vodka or whatever it was, I just gulped it down. And to this day, I know I put the bottle, or put the lid back on the bottle, but I still don't know if I put it in the door and grabbed it again, or whether I put it in the door and never let my hand off of it. But I would go around that house on my last debauch, right, my last drunk, drinking anybody's wine, didn't matter what it was. It was wine or liquor as I was after, and taking sips of bottles so no one would notice anything was missing. And I remember there's this, one of the young kids that brought this bottle of scotch, and the seal wasn't broken on it. And I had standards, right? I'm going to steal your liquor, but I'm not going to break the seal on the bottle. And I can't tell you the last thing I drank, but the last drink I remember was the third time I passed that bottle of scotch. I cracked the lid and I took a big gulp of it. And the next thing I know, my wife was waking me up, passed up on the bed, passed out on the bed. And so, you know, that would be my last debauch, that'd be my last drunk. And that was July 28th, 2014. And, you know, I haven't had the fun necessary to take a drink since then. I've been through some things in my life. I know there's gonna be some more personal family things that we're going to be dealing with here pretty shortly. I survived a health scare on my own. My wife just went through a bout with breast cancer, and she's all clear on that now. So we've had to face these challenges, and I've not thought it necessary to drink. Matter of fact, you know, I had two distinct experiences laying in that hospital gurney And one was, I was in the ER, not the ER, I was in the ICU awaiting for an emergency procedure from one that had been done here locally, and there were complications with it. I was bleeding internally, I was jaundiced, I had pancreatitis, I had all these things going on, and so that was in the ICU. ICU, yeah. And they were going to do an emergency procedure to reverse what the other doctors had done here locally and fix or repair what it was. And I just remember laying on that gurney, you know, thinking, you know, what can I do, right? There's absolutely nothing I can do. You know, in that moment, that whole feeling, that emotion, you know, came to me is, all right, God, you've got it. Because there's nothing else I can do at that point. And, you know, try and keep this good here. You know, tears streaming down my eyes as I'm laying on this gurney, and you know, then there's just this sense of peace and calm came over me. You know, and I can't explain it. You know, other than that, for me, was letting me know things were going to be okay. And then, you know, two days later, after all the things that happened as a result of what was going on, the doctors came in and say, "Okay, explain this again. Why you're here?" Because I had gone to the doc in the box because my eyes were yellow. Eyes were yellow, that's all I knew. I said, "Oh, jaundice, no pain." And I didn't find this out until about 7 days into this odyssey, that's one of the telltale signs for pancreatic cancer. Of course, no one explained that to me, right? They talk about my gallbladder, and you have to get this out, we're going to do that. Anyway, long story short, I went through several weeks of a real medical odyssey and ended up with major surgery and, you know, was put back on my feet. But the other time was when I was going in for that surgery, and the doctor had sent me home waiting for an OR, and he thought I was going to come back worse than I left, but I came back better. And you know, he was perplexed. He was questioning himself whether or not he should do the surgery. I'm like, this was a major surgery. They were going to take things out and do this whole Roto-Rooter thing and like some sort of kid's puzzle and put it all back together, is the way they were explaining it to me. That's what I heard in my head. Like, you're going to pull everything out, cut some of it off, reroute it, and then shove it back in. Yeah, that's pretty much it. So, and I found myself laying on that gurney, the same thing. It was the second time I had that experience. I said, okay, well, you know, I don't know what they're going to do. The plan was to go in there and do this procedure, but left the option open that if they didn't find cancer, that they would come up with a plan B. And thank God they didn't, and they did, and they came out and talked to the family, and they decided what they were going to do. But, you know, before that, it's like, all right, God, here we go. You know, you've got it. And it really taught me some important lessons, you know, about completely submitting yourself to something other than you, something greater than yourself. You know, I grew up going to church, and I grew up knowing God, but not having God central in my life. I prayed to a God that I thought existed, that I thought would answer my prayers. And I have several examples of immediately turning around and wanting to solve the problem myself. Like I kind of gave it out there, right? But I didn't let go of it. I just snatched it back, put it in my pocket, and went about solving the problem. And it was pointed out to me early on by my sponsor. He said, "Your problem is you lack faith." I'm like, faith. Well, you know, I believe in God. I pray. He said, "Yeah, but you don't have faith. You're praying to God, and you're trying to solve the problem yourself." And to describe it, it's like my butt's on fire, and I'm praying to God, asking him to make it rain, while I'm looking around for the hose to put it out myself. Right? So once that was explained to me, I realized that I had to really start letting go and asking for help and believing in something. And, you know, I talked earlier on about this being a spiritual program. I was taken to church most of my life. I went back as an adult because I thought that was the right thing to do as a parent. Heck, I was an elder in the church when my disease was progressing. You know, I couldn't come home at 4:30 and not have a drink before going to a 6 o'clock session meeting because that was going to be too long. By the time we got done this two-hour stinking meeting, you know, I was going to have enough time to drink before I had to go to bed. So, you know, what's wrong with that? You know, and I'm saying that I believe in God. I've got this relationship with Him, and I didn't. I came to believe that I never had a personal relationship with a God that I understood. I was taken to church. I was taught about certain things, and I believed them mainly because I didn't have anything to disprove what all these people were telling me, but also because I was afraid that they might be right and I might be wrong. So I'd rather err on the side of caution and find out that God isn't, rather than get there and find out He is. And so I started to develop that. And this program gave me a way to pray and meditate that I'd never been exposed to before. And I have such a sense of peace and calm about my life, especially in the mornings now. I'm fortunate that I'm retired. I get to get up and make my coffee and sit down. First thing I do is sit down with my daily meditations and my prayers. And the daily reflection is one of those, the 24 hours a day is one in there. I had this email that I received from somebody. I started getting it during COVID. It's called the Daily Ponderables. And in there, there's all kinds of stuff from Zen Buddhism and Native American, and there's some NA stuff, and some, they even throw some Al-Anon stuff in there once in a while. And I just go through there, and I just pick and choose what speaks to me that day. But the first two I read religiously, the Daily Reflection and the 24-hour day. And I tend to get more out of the, more spiritualness out of the 24-hour day. That was written, I think, in 1984, somewhere around there. And I don't think the Daily Reflection came out until the 90s. But yeah, there's just more of a spiritual connection for me in that there. But it's important for me to get my day started right. And because I've alluded to this before, is I have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual conditioning. So if I don't get my day started and conditioned spiritually, the day's not going to go like I want it to, right? And that's because I haven't let go of it first thing in the morning. The day's never going to go the way I want it to, but I'm aware of the fact that I'm still trying to run the show. And it was also pointed out to me early on that if I forget to do those things, until it becomes a part of my soul, a part of my memory, part of my being, that I can restart my day at any time. You know, I can start over at any point. And, you know, so that brought me here. Like I said, I've had people who have mentored me along the way that got me involved with service. I've been exposed to the inner group, the district. I've had volunteered for every position within my home group. I had the opportunity to help start a meeting and help carry that meeting. I participate in other meetings on a regular basis. My focus today is on book studies. No matter how many times we read a passage in that book, there's always something that seems to speak to me. If it's not speaking directly to me, it's listening to how somebody else perceived what they read or sharing their experience with it. It just gives me a whole new perspective on it. And it, you know, if you saw my big book, you'd see that it's fallen apart. Those first 164 pages are almost individual pages. I have a big rubber band that holds my book together at this point. But I've got so much experience and memories with the passages in there, and things that people say at a meeting. I used to write down what I call Busterisms. You know, he had these little quips and quotes, and he would tell you where they came from. I couldn't remember all those people, so I just lumped them into one category called a Busterism. And throughout my 12 and 12 and big book, there's all these little phrases that he puts in there. You know, this one he gave me tonight. You know, take a moment, go to the restroom, say a little prayer, you know, and turn your will and your life over and ask God to speak through you. And he said everything will be all right. And I like to say this gets easier, but it doesn't. You know, getting up here and bearing your soul and telling on yourself isn't fun, but it's an important part of the process. And, you know, I've never said no when asked unless I just physically couldn't be there. For some reason, I had to be out of town because I think it's an important part of service work. You know, it's part of giving back. I see the old timers, like, why do these guys keep coming back after 30 years? You know, because they need a daily reprieve too. They need to hear from us what it was like, right? Because if I forget what it was like, I don't know where I'm going because I can't remember where I've been. And, you know, when I come to these meetings, I want to hear from the people that have got 1 or 2 years and the struggles they're having, especially those in the first year. I didn't think that first year was ever going to end. And now I look back and don't know where the last few have gone, you know, because I'm just doing this thing day in and day out. You know, it's become a part of my life. You know, for me today, it's a way of life. Relating back to the military and the comparisons there, the fellowship, the camaraderie, the connection that I have with you people is very reminiscent of that I found in the military. You know, when I would go, I worked in a field where there weren't a lot of places we could go, and very likely if you stayed in and made a career of it, you're going to rotate to another assignment and you're going to know people there. And while you're there, other people are going to rotate in and you're going to remember them from somewhere else, or you're going to make new friends and meet them at another destination somewhere down the road. And that's what it's like in AA, you know. I'm terrible with names. If I don't see you for like 30 days and say your name over and over again, if you skip out for a couple weeks, I'll forget your name. I won't remember. I'll know exactly what we talked about, where we lost each other, what meeting it was at, but I just blank out with names, and I've never been good with that, and I don't know why, and I stopped wondering about others. Say, if I forget your name, I apologize. It's not that I'm doing so intentionally. I can relate all kinds of stories about you that I remember you sharing in a meeting, but I just can't remember what your doggone name was. But, so like I said, what I get out of that today, and so why does the old timer keep coming back, the person with 10, 20, or 30 years? Because we have a responsibility to do so. You know, our 12 steps says that I have a responsibility to carry the message that they're still sick and suffering alcoholic. So I come back to be reminded what and who I am, what the problem is, you know, what the solution is, and to offer my hand to be of service to someone else. And I hope that I am able to continue doing that. I hope that each time that I get asked to do this, that if you've heard me speak before, that maybe you've heard something different. You know, so it's not the same old boring story. A lot of it's probably the same, you know, because my story doesn't really change. I could tell different stories about what it was like. You know, what happened. You know, how I got here is how I got here. But what should change each time I'm asked to do this, if it's been a little while, is what it's like now. And if you can't hear something different in what I'm saying this time from what you may have heard a year or two or three ago, you know, then I need to take a look at what I'm doing and find out where am I at? Where am I at in the growth department? Because that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to continue to listen and learn and glean from you all what I can. And like I said, those little tricks of looking at somebody when they're speaking helps you to focus on them, and it draws your attention away from the guy who's, you know, folding his money into a paper hat, you know, or the other guy over here that's counting the number of times the speaker said, you know, there's a guy who used to come to the Friday night meeting, I think it was, you know, and he would sit there. You could watch him in the meeting. He'd not focus on anything other than how many times this guy said, you know, when he shared, and then he was hard of hearing, he had hearing aids, and he would turn very loudly to his sponsor sitting next to him, 33 times, 33 times he said, you know. I'm like, and this we can hear you over here. I can say that because he's gone now. But anyway, just, you know, the funny quirks that we have. So I encourage you to look for ways that you can identify in meetings. Doesn't matter if it's a man or a woman, young or old, you know, black, white, brown, red, yellow, whatever. You know, look at what they're saying or listen to what they're saying and look at what you have in common. Because it's really easy to compare ourselves out of the program. It's a lot harder to identify ourselves in. That's pretty close. I'm going to stop with that because I'm just going to start babbling at this point. Anyway, congratulations, Nina. Jake, thank you for asking me to be here. It's always a pleasure to come to this meeting and a greater pleasure to be able to speak at it. So thank you.
If you ever get the pleasure to go to a meeting with Mike, book studies, Mike talks about that a lot. Seems to be the ones he always shows up to. Early on, I heard Mike say something. We were reading that chapter that has addendum 2 in it. 4 times over 5 pages. And Mike was the first guy, and this is probably, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 months in. Mike's the first guy who stops the meeting, because this is the third time addendum 2 has been blitzed over very quickly in this chapter. I couldn't tell you how many times before this had happened in meetings. Nobody ever stopped and read it. Mike did. For me, I didn't have that amazing spiritual experience. But hearing Mike talk about it in that book study, that different perspective, mine was of the educational variety. So, thank you, Mike. Our seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting. Declining contributions, outside contributions, money collected at this meeting covers rent and supplies. The rest is given to the Tidewater Intergroup and District 24 in the General Services Office. Are there any AA-related announcements? Jake?
Jake, non-alcoholic.
Jake?
The District 24 annual picnic is happening September 21st. And it starts at 11, ends at 2. We are going to be at Shelter 3 when you get there. And the district's going to be providing a lot of food and drinks. And we're going to have a face painter out there, a couple face painters to paint kids' faces. And then we're also going to have a song circle. And so please bring, if you're a musician, please bring your instruments and come join us in the song circle. I think Greg is going to be out there with his guitar. So we're also going to have some other people do that. And so it's designed for families of alcoholics. Alcoholics, bring your families, bring your children, your significant others, and have fun. So thanks.
Thanks, Jake. Sure. Any other AA-related announcements? If anybody's interested in the picnic, there's a flyer up here. Please feel free to come up and take a picture and spread the word. On Thursday, September the 12th at 6:15 to 8 p.m., the Friends of Bill W. group will be doing dinner and a workshop, focusing on steps 6 and 7. The panelists will be Bob C. from Sunbury, Heidi K. from the Indian River 12 Step, and Margaret L. from Carrying the Message in Portsmouth. If you'd like to have a copy of that one, I got one too. On Friday, October the 11th, 6:30 p.m., St. Paul's Episcopal Church, North Main Street, Suffolk, 55th anniversary celebration of the Suffolk Discussion Group. There will be AA and Al-Anon speakers. AA speaker would be Diane B., Saturday Roundtable Group, Norfolk, Virginia, and the Al-Anon speaker will be Kathleen C., Keeping It Simple from Chesapeake. If you like that, it's up here as well. I have asked, well, I'll tell you what, here's what we're going to do. We got some special stuff tonight, so I'm going to take the front end of this one and do some chips. So in the Tidewater area, we have chips that denote, as Mike pointed out, continuous sobriety. Has anybody heard anything tonight? The most important chip, the 24-hour chip. Anybody want to pick up a white? No? Set that one down. Let's see. 30 days. Anybody got 30 days? Orange, you glad you got 30. 60 days. Anybody got 60 days? Got a burgundy chip? Nope. 90 days, red chip. Red should have left your eyes by now. Nope. Blue chip, 6 months. Blue skies ahead. Green, 9 months. Anybody got 9 months? Grass should be growing back between your car and the 7-Eleven. Yellow chip, 1 year or more from another home group. No takers. And one more time on the white. Give up the fight. No. Tonight, we are celebrating a couple special things. So we have asked a friend to come up and do a chip presentation for us.